Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Monday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. She invites you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts as we complete reading Samuel Hahnemann's Organon. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, taking time out each Monday to begin with some inspiration, to talk a little bit about current events, maybe a lot today about current events, and to read the words of Dr. Samuel Hahnemann in his Organon of Medicine. Today is November 29, 2010, and you're listening to show number 122. Thank you to all those who are listening today, and don't forget you can get the archives and download them to your computer, your iTunes, your iPod, and also to remember and remind everyone that this is a study session. Any listeners must consult their healthcare provider. Today's inspirational quote is, if you want to lift yourself up, lift someone else up. This is by Booker T. Washington. He lived in 1856 to 1915. So today's inspiration is really a shout out to all those who are working in the field of homeopathy, saving lives, supporting the suffering, through emotional and physical illnesses. There are so many people that I would like to thank and bring attention to their work. This is a shout out to all those who are making headlines and getting homeopathy into the news media to create that wave of awareness, to create information, education, to dispel myths and correct misconceptions about what homeopathy is and how it works. We know that many more people will need homeopathy as a support system through the coming months and years as we undergo environmental, economic, and social transitions. I just received an announcement that will cause some shockwaves across a nation. We know that stress is a major factor in all disease and illness. We also know that words can hurt and words can heal. Today I just received a message. President Obama announced a pay freeze for most federal workers. He will announce this later today, according to an administration official. The latest White House move is intended to demonstrate concern over deficit spending. The president's announcement will effectively wipe out plans for a 1.4% across-the-board raise for most of the 2.1 million federal government employees in the year 2011. That's a lot of people this news is going to affect. The president has frozen the salaries of his own top White House staff members since taking office 22 months ago. You can look at that article on the New York Times. I'm sure it is more thorough. I want to thank everyone who is listening and on the chat line. If you have any comments, I'll take a look at them, and if I can, I will read them over the air. I also want to give a shout out to Dr. Greg Meyer. He was recently in the CNN news about the Haiti School for the Handicapped that gets homeopathic health care. Dr. Greg Meyer is a homeopathic physician and an urgent care physician. He is an avid camper, hiker, and traveler, and a photographer. And he's been to about 30 countries. He took microbiology and epidemiology and studied medicine, and more recently has become fascinated with how homeopathy can actually cure disease. Yes, I did say cure. And better said, how it allows the body to actually heal itself. So true, Dr. Meyer, MD, we want to thank you. He is practicing homeopathy at a nursing school and teaching at the School for the Handicapped. He said that there was no cholera in the area at the time of his report, but everyone is very nervous about it, and everyone is cautious and washing their hands. This was in the recent CNN report where he said he was at the St. Vincent's School for the Handicapped Children. The children are taught their value, what they can do. Everyone is important to someone else. So we see those with legs helping those who can't walk. This is a quote. Ones who can't see are led by kids who can see but are deaf, and they are learning Braille, typing. What is interesting is that when they come in to see one of the volunteer homeopaths, usually they never complain about the thing we notice first about them. The blindness, the limping, the missing arm is not why they are there to see us. It is because of headaches, eye irritation, stomach ache, or rash. Your heart cannot help but go out to help them. They are just kids posing for the camera and hamming it up sometimes, but they have suffered so much already in their short years. The school is like a sanctuary. It is clean, happy, organized. Much, much different from when you step beyond the gate to the clamor of the city to the outside world. And I wanted to also give you an update about cholera in Haiti. On November 24th, the WHO gave out a message. As of the 20th of November 2010, the Haitian Ministry of Public Health and Population, the MSPP, reported 240 cumulative cholera cases, including 1,000, that must be 60,240. They have a problem with their writing of their numerical values on their website, including 1,415 deaths at the national level. The case fatality rate in hospitals at the national level is 2.3%, with 67% of the deaths occurring at health services level and 33% at community level. In Port-au-Prince and metropolitan areas, 5,778 cases, including 95 deaths, have been reported. On November 19th, the Ministry of Health of the Dominican Republic reported two cases tested positive for cholera. One person is hospitalized and the other receiving treatment at his residence in Santo Domingo. And you can read the rest of that cholera update, breaking news from the World Health Organization. The National Cholera Response Plan identifies the need to urgently scale up oral rehydration centers at the community level to provide services to non-life-threatening cases and serve as a contact point for referring non-severe patients to cholera treatment units and severe patients to cholera treatment centers. So there's a difference in the type of place where the ill person is treated. It is either the unit or the unit for the non-severe or the center for the more severe cases. So they need a lot of help, and maybe some more homeopaths will be going there and giving some assistance homeopathically. I wanted to give a shout out also to my wonderful Homeopathy World community. So much is going on there. There's a banner for becoming part of the movie and donating to the Blind Dog film. And I spoke recently to Laurel Chitten, who is the producer of this upcoming movie. Maybe it will be out in a year or so, depending on how much funding she gets. And we really need to support her work, because I have so much admiration for what she is doing. She is not a homeopath. She is a film producer, an award-winning film producer. And if there is somebody who we need to applaud and support, it's the person who is talking about homeopathy in a bright light, in a positive way, showing what it can do in the world for people who are sick, for children who have autism, for the people who have volunteered. Homeopaths Without Borders, they have gone down to Haiti and helped out as much as they can, and we need to promote their work. Laurel is there with the movie aspect. This would create a tremendous wave of awareness if it was seen on PBS on the general theaters, in the general theaters, and on our television sets. So I want to encourage people to give her some support. Also, I wanted to say hello to Dr. Rajneesh Kumar Sharma of Homeopathy World Community. He has been a great help on the network. He usually greets new members and writes fantastic blogs and articles. The latest one that he's written is called Falls and Off Legs. And this is about something very important to the elderly, because it is a major cause of fear and concern that the elderly will fall, and once they do, and injure their hip and have surgery, that seems to be the road down for them. So I'm going to read a little bit of Dr. Rajneesh, his article, Falls and Off Legs. If a person falls on the ground suddenly and is brought to you, it is very difficult to make the case history. So what he's after, he wants to understand the cause, what's happening, why is a person falling. So he says the points to assess in the case after a fall is the person's history. What are the circumstances of the fall? Take note of the place, the time of day. Were there any witnesses who could tell you what they saw and observed? Take note of the symptoms before the fall. Was there pre-syncope, syncope, or palpitations? What was leading to this fall, which the person might have sustained injuries? And so you need to know what kind of injuries were sustained. Were there broken bones? Was there organs that were harmed? Were there bruises that were sustained? He wants to know, what are the contributory factors? Was it dementia, a previous stroke, Parkinson's, lower limb joint disorders, or even foot disorders? And he's written another article on the network about heel pain. So it goes, he's kind of tying it together there. He wants to know also, were there any previous falls? Is this something that the person is typically doing? And he wants to learn a little bit about previous syncope. And let me tell you that syncope is a medical term for fainting, a sudden, unusual, temporary loss of consciousness, generally caused by insufficient oxygen in the brain, either through cerebral hypoxia or through hypotension, but possibly other reasons. A pre- or near syncope is diagnosed if the individual can remember events during the loss of consciousness, such as reporting and remembering dizziness, blurred vision, and muscle weakness, and the fall previous to hitting his or her head and losing consciousness. As the loss of consciousness is a symptom for a variety of conditions and syncope is difficult to rule out outside of a hospital, a thorough examination is required in order to determine the cause, including interviews with witnesses as well as evaluation with an electrocardiogram. If the individual remembers feeling dizzy or loss of vision but not the fall, then it is considered a syncoptic episode. Typical symptoms progress through dizziness, clamminess of the skin, a dimming of vision or gray out, possibly tinnitus, complete loss of vision, weakness of limbs to physical collapse. These symptoms, falling short of complete collapse or a fall down, may be referred to as a syncoptic episode. So you can see there are quite a few symptoms that can be included in such an event that could be utilized in a homeopathic treatment, where we would look up all of the rubrics for each of the symptoms that have occurred and put them into a holistic picture to understand what is going on with the individual. Dr. Rajneesh gives us further information to say that, what about unusual effort or tolerance? Does the person typically have a difficult time climbing stairs? Are they able to walk on a flat surface? Are they able to manage activities of daily living? So you're just getting their day-to-day situation. And what else does he have to say about these falls? He says that, does the person typically use a walking aid? So we can understand where they are at in their illness, if the fall is part of something that they typically have. Is the fall happening at their home, in their usual environment, or are there environmental hazards, loose rugs, poor lighting, a slippery floor? So if you are a caretaker, you want to be sure to make sure that their way is clear and safe for them. And even in a home, I mean, typically we understand that kids leaving their toys lying around on the floor, on the staircase, if this is just a message that something's going to happen. So if you're walking around and you see something on the floor, pick it up. It's just helping everyone to prevent an accident from occurring. What about medications? Check and see if the person is taking sedatives, hypnotics, antidepressants, antihypertensives, or other kinds of multiple drugs. We know that if you're in allergy season, that these types of antihistamines can cause drowsiness. Are you, not only should you not be driving, but take care in how you're getting along. Also, he notes that if a person has a history of alcohol abuse or alcohol history, then this could also contribute to falls. And lastly, he wants to know if they're living in a residential home, a nursing care home, where are they? And this is important information. He then says, key to your examinations, which I did notice in the definition of syncope itself, but you want to take a look at when you're having this examination, if there were any head injuries sustained, any concussions, any fractures, joint dislocations, or soft tissue bruising or laceration. You want to assess the mental state of the individual. This could probably tell you whether they've been on drugs, medications, or alcohol to preface the falling incident. If the patient does not have any evidence of acute illness or injury, screening for neurological and musculoskeletal disorders with the get up and go test. So he's telling us about other kinds of testing that an individual might undergo if they have fallen and have been taken to the physician or to the hospital. Ask the patient to stand up from a chair without using the arms. Walk several paces and return. Can this be done without difficulty or unsteadiness? And if you take a look at his article, they have further reading, references, and a flow chart, which is really comprehensive. I wanted to also mention with the causations, we have environmental factors, we have medication, we also have osteoporosis in the aged, or when you're taking medication that could lead to falls, like taking Fosamax or other kinds of bone hardening medications can cause to brittle bones. There's also toxicity effects of the brain when a person is in contact with lead or other kinds of heavy metals. He mentioned alcohol abuse, just typically of the aging process, and it was mentioned in the syncope that there could be loss of vision. What about persons who are totally inactive, sedentary persons who do not tone up their muscles and therefore don't have any coordination? And this is going to lead to another piece of information, an article recently in the New York Times, which was about a study showing how music, movement, and exercise can improve balance and reduce the risk of falls by half. We all know that the comparisons of infants and the elderly in their life cycle from birth to death, from needing care to loss of function, is in the beginning when we care and love our little ones and bring them up and nurture them, to the downside when the elderly are now losing their functions. We learn that the elderly in this particular study that is cited in the New York Times, when the elderly took a eurythmics class that was designed for young children, it actually improved their standing, ability to stand steadily, and they had less falls. We also know that people who stutter can frequently speak perfectly clearly and well, smoothly, when they're singing. those who cannot speak somehow are enabled to, when speaking in rhyme or song, they can speak fine. So we have a tremendous connection between music, like called the Mozart effect, music and the brain function, music and movement, music and language, and for stabilizing an individual. Here we had this 12-month trial where they recruited 134 people with an average age of 75. It would be great if they had a larger base of people in the study who were unsteady on their feet. Half of them were randomly assigned to weekly hour-long eurythmics classes for the full year, and the other half for just the last 6 months. The program developed by the early 20th century Swiss composer Emile Jacques Delcroix teaches movement in time to music, from Mozart minuets to jazz improvisations. Participants have to walk and turn around, stay in step with changing tempos, learn to shift their weight and balance, handle objects while walking, and make exaggerated upper body movements while standing and walking. I want to interject here that Qigong also can have the same type of effect for improving the risk of falling and creating steady and movement, because Qigong is so helpful in creating that mind-body awareness. It brings the two together. It forces the individual to become totally aware of how their body moves. In this particular study, the two groups were monitored outside of class to determine how many times they fell. In the full year group, there were just 24 falls over the first 6 months, compared to 54 among those who were not taking the class. So this is twice. It's a double. Even after the classes ended, the participants maintained their improvements in balance. They walked with a more regular gait and enhanced their ability to walk while doing other things, like having a conversation. It's sort of like talking and chewing gum, what's it, patting your head and rubbing your tummy. The study was published online in Archives of Internal Medicine on November 22, 2010, and will be in the print edition on March 28th. The paper's lead author, Dr. Andrea Trombetti of the University Hospitals and Faculty of Medicine of Geneva, Switzerland, said that despite the striking results, it was still unclear how music affected people's walking and gait. From that, I say, even though we don't know how it works, we can still utilize this phenomena that supports and steadies a person on their feet. Let's institute more dance and music classes for the elderly. I mean, if this was designed for children, we could have it in all age levels. We want to get them into the swing of things. We want to provide the synesthetic experience so that they can get in touch with their bodies, move their muscles, tone up, and feel better about themselves. So it affects self-esteem. If you're fearful, if you're concerned about falling, you're not going to get out into your social environment. You want to be able to move and feel that sense of freedom. And to do that, let's use music and exercise. So that's my little rant for today about music and movement and how we can really understand what's going on with a person who is possibly falling. I want to also talk a little bit about an article that was written by Tony Isaacs, a citizen journalist for Natural News, and you can check on the Twitter, and I think this is being blasted all over the internet. He wrote an article called Possibly Over 3,000 Miscarriages, the CDC is Still Lying About H1N1 Vaccine Safety. And in Natural News, he wrote this. It's a shocking report. The National Coalition of Organized Women, NCOW, presented data in September from two different sources demonstrating that the 2009-2010 H1N1 vaccines contributed to as many as 3,587 cases of miscarriage and still deaths. Despite having the data, the CDC has continued to assure pregnant women a prime vaccine target group and vaccine providers that the vaccine presents no risk for pregnant women. I have a feeling that that might have changed since the posting of this article. We're gonna have to do some research and find out that information. The NCOW used data from their own survey of pregnant women aged 17 to 45 years of age and the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, that's the VAERS, the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which includes updates through July 11th to estimate the true number of miscarriages and stillbirths following an H1N1 flu vaccination in the United States. The NCOW estimated the number of miscarriages and stillbirths due to the H1N1 vaccine during that flu season to be 1,588, but they also noted that the figure was an average and that the number of miscarriages and stillbirths could have been as high as 3,587. That's 2,000 more than what is reported. During the Advisory Commission on Childhood Vaccines, the ACCV meeting on September 3, 2010, Eileen Daneman, director of the NCOW, presented the findings for the second time to Dr. Mary McCormick, chair of the Vaccine Risk and Assessment Working Group, just prior to Daneman's presentation. Dr. McCormick had pronounced that there were absolutely no H1N1 vaccine-related adverse events in pregnant women in 2009-2010, directly contradicting the evidence publicly available. Quote, this baseless and fallacious assessment by the CDC assessment group has given the green light to the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP, to continue their recommendation to give the 2010 and 2011 flu shot to all people, including pregnant women. Unquote, says Daneman. She also noted that the upcoming 2010 and 11 flu vaccine contains the same elements that are implicated in the killing of these fetuses, the H1N1 viral component and the neurotoxin mercury, which we call thimerosal, plus two other viral strains. The following week at the September 14th National Vaccine Advisory Committee meeting, Dr. McCormick pronounced once again that there were no adverse events in pregnant women, despite having been informed of two previous occasions of the VAERS data. At the conclusion of the NVAC meeting, Daneman submitted the data for the third time during public comment and asked, why hasn't Dr. McCormick looked at the VAERS database? Unquote. Daneman's answer is, she looked where she knew she would not find. So this is really incredible that it takes continuous repetition to get this message out. The NCOW report states, it must be argued that the CDC was grossly negligent to fail to inform their vaccine providers of the incoming VAERS data, while providers blindly followed the CDC standard of care guidelines to vaccinate every pregnant woman in 2009 and 2010. Furthermore, in the face of these findings and the purposeful withholding of these findings by CDC's Dr. Marie McCormick and her Vaccine Risk Assessment Group for the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to recommend another iteration of the same vaccine to pregnant women in the year 2010-2011 may be argued as more than gross negligence, but rather an act of willful misconduct. So I don't know whether there's going to be any legal suits regarding this. What is going to happen? How many more women and potential children will be affected by this vaccine? I think it's an important issue, and that's why I'm announcing it today. Dr. Isaacs is a natural health author, an advocate, and researcher who hosts the Best Years in Life website for baby boomers and others wishing to avoid prescription drugs and mainstream managed illness and live longer, healthier, and happier lives naturally. He is the author of books and articles about natural longevity and beating cancer, including the book Cancer's Natural Enemy. He's also working on a new book, and he resides in East Texas. Okay, let's do a little bit of our study of the Organon. Today, we're going to be reading aphorism number 120, and I see if anybody is listening on the A Homeopathy World Community website today. We have so much wonderful activity and people who keep writing about all types of articles for healing, for health, for general health, even one on nutrition. So I want to thank you all for listening. Also, just before we get into the Organon, I wanted to mention that there's a website called Homeopathy Medicine for the 21st Century. It's called hmc21.org. Take a look over there and get active with the issues, because they are helping to promote homeopathy and dispel myths and articles that are in the negative light about homeopathy. Today's aphorism reading is number 120. Dr. Samuel Hahnemann writes, "Therefore, medicines on which depend man's life and death, disease and health, must be thoroughly and most carefully distinguished from one another, and for this purpose, tested by careful, pure experiments on the healthy body, for the purpose of ascertaining their powers and real effects, in order to obtain an accurate knowledge of them, and to enable us to avoid any mistake in their employment in diseases, for it is only by correct selection of them that the greatest of all earthly blessings, the health of the body and of the mind, can be rapidly and permanently restored." And here Hahnemann hearkening back to the beginnings of the Organon, hearkening back to the way that homeopathy can be very quick-acting remedy, can be helpful in all kinds of illnesses to reduce suffering, which is what we're aiming at. I will repeat the first aphorism: the physician's high and only mission is to restore the sick to health, to cure, as it is termed. Aphorism number two is: the highest ideal of cure is rapid, gentle, and permanent restoration of the health, or removal and annihilation of the disease in its whole extent, in the shortest, most reliable, and most harmless way, on easy, comprehensible principles. And he's been telling us these principles throughout the reading of the Organon, and today's reading of aphorism number 120 tells us that we can completely and thoroughly have, faith, but reliability upon the medicines of which we have complete knowledge. This means that a homeopath must understand the remedies, what the remedies can do on a healthy body, as shown in proving. So these aphorisms are dealing with provings and understanding how we learn about medicines, how we learn about their effects on the body, and the fact that it is pure science. This is experiments. This is gathering of data, gathering of knowledge. It is not totally anecdotal in that way, because we're creating a record, a body of knowledge that can tell us what will happen in certain instances. Just like in clinical trials in the traditional Western method, they do these clinical trials and record certain outcomes of medicines. So they're treating a heart problem and they find out that it helps a person who has hair loss. And now they're taking that observation, they're using it to give persons who have alopecia this medication. Whereas they're not taking into consideration what are the effects on the heart, what are the effects on holistically on the entire person. even emotionally, mentally? Are they taking those into account? And a homeopath is a person who does, because they're recording all the effects so that the homeopath knows the totality of symptoms. They know everything that is going to be included when they give a drug, a medicine, a remedy. Hahnemann says here that we need to obtain accurate knowledge and to enable us to avoid any mistake in their employment in diseases. Therefore, how do you discern the fine-tuning between one remedy and another, which have many overlapping symptoms? This means that we must know what actions these remedies can provoke in a healthy individual. And then we use it for those who are not feeling well, who are ill, and have those set of symptoms. It is only by correct selection of them that the greatest of all earthly blessings, the health of the body and of the mind, can be rapidly and permanently restored. So here we are concerned as homeopaths about the whole being, the whole organism, the individual's physical care and their mental care. So if you give something that's going to help an individual, we want to make sure that it's going to be curative on all levels. We're not going to give a medication in a crude dose, which is typically done in regular medicine, that it might alleviate a particular physical symptom, but then on the mental symptom, they have very, very harsh emotional results. And so we don't want that to occur. Now we're going to go on to reading number 121 and see if anybody, we've got another guest in the chat line. Thanks so much for listening. The Organon aphorism number 121. Hahnemann states, improving medicines to ascertain their effects on the healthy body, it must be borne in mind that the strong heroic substances, as they are termed, are liable even in small doses to produce changes in the health even of robust persons. Those of milder power must be given for those experiments in more considerable quantities in order to observe the action of the very weakest. However, the subjects of experiment should be persons free from disease and who are delicate, irritable, and sensitive. So again, he is teaching us about how we manage a proving. So when we are gathering together persons who are going to be part of this proving to find out what a potential responses or remedy can provoke, we want to get robust persons, healthy persons, so we can see what the remedy can, what changes can occur in a healthy individual, someone with a strong vital force. And this is very, very important, because in a previous aphorism, I believe it was 119, he was explaining how things in our environment, potent, strong, toxic, or whatever the substance is, can provoke responses even in actually every individual across the board. And so he wants to know what is the response of those persons who are even strong, who might not typically get a response from something in their environment. What is the power of that substance? And then he also goes on to state, in order to observe the action in the very weakest, the subject of experiment should be persons free from disease and who are delicate, irritable, and sensitive. So what he's hearkening back to are those persons who are hypersensitive. There's healthy individuals who, when undergoing approving meaning that you're going to be taking a succussed and potentized diluted remedy that typically is not going to cause much of an effect, but if you repeatedly take that same medicine, you're going to eventually sensitize the individual to provoke a response. And there are very healthy individuals who will be hypersensitive, and those are persons who will provoke a response that typically the other person's in approving may not have. And we need to take those responses into consideration in the collaboration and aggregation of all of the symptoms that are going to be observed. So I hope that makes sense of aphorism number 121. We're going to move on to aphorism number 122. Okay, so there is a question in the chat room. How do homeopaths do provings on healthy people when indeed everyone has something wrong with them? That is an excellent question. And he's also asked, has anyone totally been free of disease? Well, what we do is, it's true. In today's world, there are very few people who are 100% free of disease, who are free of illness. But there are people who are generally healthy. And most often, homeopaths are doing these provings on other homeopaths. From the beginning of homeopathy, it was Hahnemann and his colleagues, his peers who were studying homeopathy, who took remedies themselves, who did provings on themselves. And in the same way, provings are continued today in the same kind of experimental and experiential way. Persons who are very interested in homeopathy are going to be the ones who are going to volunteer as part of taking part in the experiments. These are close-knit groups of people typically because, to begin with, in the proving, we do an assessment of each and every individual. Very often in a traditional clinical trial, they also take an assessment of the individual. They want to know how the person is before taking a drug so that they can differentiate what is part of the proving symptom and what is part of their natural way of being. If they typically have vertigo, if they typically have a cough, if they typically have indigestion, what is going on with them in their normal day-to-day life, and then what happens as a result of taking this drug or medicine or remedy. So what we do is we assess that at the beginning for each and every person. And we also want to know, typically homeopaths have been given remedies to improve their health so that they have a stronger vital force to begin with, and they are stronger individuals. And they also could be very sensitive individuals. Let me know if that has helped to answer this question about how do homeopaths do provings on healthy people when indeed everyone has something wrong with them. We try to find out how healthy they are, and those are the there are persons who are eliminated from doing a proving because their health is not up to par. So we want to really take persons who are healthy. And in Hahnemann's day, people were much, much stronger, much, much less impacted with the number of environmental pollutants and medicines. There were a lot of people who were not vaccinated. There were a lot of people who had a good, strong genealogy, and those people were probably included in the provings of that day. Today, we're reproving some of the old remedies to see if there's anything new or to reconfirm what Hahnemann did. And he also, this person in the chat, Dr. Bob Hall, also asked, is anyone totally free of disease? That I don't know if I can answer that one. I think we're all impacted. We all have weaknesses and susceptibilities in our makeup. So I think that there are people who are not displaying symptoms and are pretty healthy, and then there are people who are more weaker in general. I don't know about what our – I would say, to answer that question a little bit further, that a high percentage, I don't know whether it's 75%, 90%, and any number off the top of my head, I don't want to give that. But in Hahnemann's thinking, obstacles to cure, and something we've talked about previously, if you have a better lifestyle if you're eating organic nutritional foods, if you're not taking in lots of sugars, if you're drinking clean water, if you have a more of a stress-free life, then you're going to be healthier in general. And I think our contemporary life has impacted us tremendously with whether it's the means of communication is such a high-paced type of living, do it now, expect it now, a lot of stress. And what I said at the beginning of the show about jobs, this is causing more stress to general whole populations. We have another comment. Wouldn't a person's constitutional remedy affect approving? Okay. Well, if a person is under a homeopathic care and they are taking their remedy in the proper way, which means it's not being repeated very often, typically, unless they're on some kind of medication, a person's constitutional remedy will not affect approving. We have just finished reading in previous aphorisms the how homeopathic remedies work in their primary and secondary effect. And once a person notices that the remedy is working, we then stop giving it. Approving means that we continually give this remedy until action, until the vital force provokes a response, and then we stop giving it. So there is a mode of action and a timing, and this is what's called the proving, which is we repeat it until we see a response, and then we stop giving it. And in homeopathic care, we're not continually repeating. We don't need to keep, you know, once you hit that mark, once you initiate a response, it's not necessary to keep banging the person over the head with their remedy. So hopefully we're not going to be causing any proving symptoms for that individual. Hopefully what is happening, if the person gets the correct constitutional remedy, it will alleviate the symptoms. It will remove the symptoms for a complete and total cure. The health of the body and of the mind rapidly and permanently restored, as Hahnemann just stated in aphorism 120. If there's no more questions, I think I'm going to go ahead and read the next aphorism for today. I hope that answered the question. Aphorism number 122. In these experiments, on which depends the exactitude of the whole medical art and the weal of all future generations of mankind, no other medicines should be employed except such as are perfectly well known and of whose purity, genuineness, and energy we are thoroughly assured. So here he's speaking to the homeopathic community. He's telling the homeopathic community that we're using remedies that we have scientifically proven through these experiments, that we're, you know, the basic 50 homeopathic remedies that have been used for over 200 years can alleviate the majority of symptoms that individuals incur today. And there's a good reason to rely and employ those remedies that are well known, that we have encyclopedic proving cases, which are listed in the Materia Medica, which we can use our resource of the repertories to look up the symptoms and the rubrics of each symptoms, to look up the concomitants, to look up the generalities, to look up how a person feels, better or worse, in our source materia, in our resources. So he's saying, use those remedies which are well known of purity, genuineness, and the energy which we are thoroughly assured. So this is what Hahnemann is recommending to us. Okay. I'm going to move on to aphorism number 123. I'm hoping that the homeopaths who have listened to that aphorism number 122, we'll take that to heart. Aphorism number 123 states, each of these medicines must be taken in a perfectly simple, unadulterated form. The indigenous plants, in the form of freshly expressed juice mixed with a little alcohol to prevent its spoiling, exotic vegetable substances, however, in the form of powder or tincture prepared with alcohol when they were in the fresh state and afterwards mingled with a certain proportion of water, salts, and gums, however, should be dissolved in water just before being taken. If the plant can only be procured in its dry state and if its powers are naturally weak, in that case, there may be used for the experiment an infusion of it made by cutting the herb into small pieces and pouring boiling water on it so as to extract its medicinal parts. Immediately after its preparation, it must be swallowed while still warm, as all expressed vegetable juices and all aqueous infusions of herbs without the addition of spirit pass rapidly into fermentation and decomposition, whereby all their medicinal properties are lost. And here, aphorism number 123 is telling exactly what I've stated from the beginning of the Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy Radio Show, Who's Reading the Organon? Basically, Hahnemann has written the very first how-to book. And he does this by taking us step-by-step through the guiding principles of homeopathy. He teaches us how and why we should be using homeopathy, and then he gives us actual instructions for how to procure and create the remedies, how to make the remedies, and where and when they should be used. So he's stating here that each of the medicines must be taken in a perfectly simple, unadulterated form. This means that we're not mixing remedies. We're taking the plant from the earth, from its natural habitat. We're taking particular parts of the plant, whether it is the leaves, the berries, the flowers, the bark, the roots. He gives instructions for that and which parts are being used. He tells us how we mix it and how we create the remedy by mixing it with alcohol, which is to prevent spoilage. It also creates the mother tincture. The exotic vegetable substances, which are in the form of powder or tincture prepared with alcohol, were in their fresh state. So he's saying some of the remedies can be in a powdered form. After mingled with a certain proportion of water, and we know today there's a lot of conversation about the power of water, how water itself can contain a memory of the substance, and there's a lot of physical evidence for this today, and perhaps in another show we will get into that, but it's a combination of alcohol and water. And then he says the certain proportion of water, salts, and gums should be dissolved in the water just before being taken. If the plant can only be procured in its dry state, and if its powers are naturally weak, in that case, there may be used for the experiment an infusion. So here he's telling us that an infusion, how we make an infusion, by pouring the boiling water over the herb. So that is another method for procuring the power of the particular herb or vegetable, and it's medicinal, and it extracts its medicinal parts. Okay, so we have a comment on the chat line. It seems that the producers of homeopathic remedies must be very careful about the raw materials they use. There is a lot of contamination out there. Well, I'm not exactly sure what you're relating to, because Hahnemann says that we're taking the natural plant from its natural habitat. I'm not sure where the contamination is. I think that the homeopaths must be very, very careful because many of the substances are toxic, and therefore even touching certain substances could create illness or responses in the body. For instance, urtica orans, if you touch this plant, you're going to get a very, very strong, powerful response of itching and rash and other kinds of debility in the body. So they have to be careful about handling their materials. They also have to be very sure about procuring and labeling their substances properly so that they are indicating the correct remedy when they're doing the experimenting and giving it as a curative action. I hope that has answered the question. I'm not sure I understand it fully. So if the plant can be only procured in the dry state and if its powers are naturally weak, Hahnemann says that it is acceptable to make an infusion. He also states immediately after its preparation it must be swallowed while still warm. And this is quite interesting. He's really giving us the best way to take the remedies. As all expressed vegetable juices and all aqueous infusions of herbs without the addition of spirit pass rapidly into fermentation and decomposition, whereby all their medicinal properties are lost. So here he's telling us the properties of plants, the properties of vegetable juices, that even when we are eating our foods, our natural organic foods, as soon as you cut it and expose it to oxygen, it's starting the process of decomposition and we're losing the vital nutrients in the plant. In the same way, he's actually telling us the same thing, that once you create a preparation and you're creating an infusion, take it while it's warm because it's going to have the most potent effect when it's in that state. Because the longer it goes without being preserved using an alcohol, it's going to start the fermentation and decomposition process. Well, we have read aphorisms 120, 21, 22, and 23 today. There's just a minute left, and I can go ahead and read aphorism number 124. For these experiments, every medicinal substance must be employed quite alone and perfectly pure, without the admixture of any foreign substance, and without taking anything else of a medicinal nature the same day, nor yet on the subsequent days, nor during all the time we wish to observe the effects of the medicine. So here we're continuing with the information about how to do provings, that in a most scientific manner we are doing an isolated case of only one thing at a time, and therefore it is purely scientific. Purely, this experiment is valid and true and sure. And we have no more time left in today's show. I want to thank all those who listened and contributed, those who commented, provided questions. I hope it was beneficial in your study of the Organon. And continue to listen and study and read what's up on the network. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon with host Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to take your Organon off the shelf and read it.